Live from the CPBN Learning Lab, this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This is the home of the Journalism and Media Academy Magnet High School Satellite Campus and Institute of Advanced Media. And we're thrilled to be here with a panel of teachers talking with a group of teachers about teaching. Now, every day at 9 o'clock, we hold a conversation with Connecticut that takes place about a wide range of issues. But more and more, it seems that the main topic on people's minds in our state is education. There's a basic problem with what's happening, though. The group of people I want to call in our show, the people who I want to engage with us on a daily basis, the people with most insight, the most experience in teaching are, well, teachers. And what are teachers doing at 9 a.m.? Anyone? They're teaching. So we're here in this beautiful new school space inside the CPBN headquarters on Asylum Avenue in Hartford. And this place is just one floor up from our studios at WNPR. It's the first time we've broadcast from here, and we're thrilled to be partnering with the Learning Lab on this event. We're going to be talking to an inspiring panel of teachers who've joined us today, but we also want to hear from our audience, a group of educators and others who've joined us, so we will be passing around a microphone in just a bit. But first, let me welcome in our guests. Liz Natale teaches English and Language Arts at Sedgwick Middle School in West Hartford. She wrote a viral op-ed for the Hartford Current, Why I Want to Give Up Teaching. Liz, welcome to our show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Next to Liz is David Bossa, who's social studies teacher at Berlin High School and the 2012 Connecticut Teacher of the Year. David, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Ebony Murphy Root is currently a middle school humanities teacher at a private school in New York City, but she still lives in Hartford and has been a teacher at several schools here. Ebony, thank you so much for being here as well.
Very glad to be here.
And David Lowe teaches aquaculture technology and mathematics at the Sound School in New Haven. He's vice president of high schools for the New Haven Federation of Teachers and 2012 New Haven Teacher of the Year. Thank you, David.
Thanks for having all of us.
So first of all, Liz, I want to start with you because of this op-ed that you wrote for the Hartford Current that many, many people have now seen. A lot of the teachers who are in this room and others shared this on Facebook and Twitter. Why did you write this piece?
Why did I write it? I wrote it because I was tired of listening to myself and tired of listening to other people complaining about what's going on in schools. Everywhere I turned, no matter what school I went to, no matter what grade I was dealing with, I was talking to teachers who were frustrated and unhappy, and they kept talking about it, and I kept talking about it. And eventually, one Saturday morning when I was doing my usual complaining about what it's like to be a teacher on the weekend. No, I can't go to the movies, I say to my husband, because I have all these papers to grade and these lessons to plan. He looked at me and said, what are you going to do about it? I mean, you keep hearing the same thing over and over again. What are you going to do? And so at that point, having been a journalist in the past, I was a newspaper reporter and I did public relations for a number of colleges, I decided to pick up my pen, not literally because I was working on my laptop, but I decided to just, you know, I thought maybe if I just get it out and write something about it, it will clear my mind, I'll feel better. And once I had the piece, I decided why not share it with everyone? Let me see if I can get a newspaper to print it. Because I decided that it was time for somebody to stand up and talk publicly about what's been going on.
You talk about this in your piece, but maybe you can tell us why you got into teaching in the first place.
Well, I had been a newspaper reporter where I covered education, and then I went into public relations working for colleges. And after 15 years or so of doing that, I decided that I was tired of being a cheerleader for education, that I really wanted to be an educator myself and not just talking to students about the institutions where I was working, but actually to do some teaching. So I went back to school. I decided that I really wanted to do something with children, not just to share my love of language and my love of teaching, but also to help shape them as citizens, as kind, generous people who would make a difference in the world themselves. So it was more than just the teaching aspect of it. I really wanted to engage with students in their lives and make a difference in their lives.
I'd like to ask the other panel, maybe I'll just go down and start with you, David. Why did you get into teaching in the first place?
It sounds cliche, but I'm sure everybody in this room has either that pinpoint moment or they're drawn, it's almost like a calling. They're drawn to the vocational nature of this work and the moral purpose and those higher ideals of education. And so for me, and this has sort of grown over the years as I've as I've gone through my career, it's that internal motivation, that intrinsic motivation. And a lot of the issues that affect teachers are when these extrinsic motivators influence the work that we do, and they affect how we perceive ourselves. And so such a big sense of who we are, our professional identities, are rooted in that intrinsic motivation that's of a higher calling.
Yeah. Ebony, how about you?
My first job out of college when I was 22 was teaching GED to pregnant and parenting teens in Springfield. So I still lived in Hartford. I would drive 40 minutes a day. And the youngest young woman that I ever taught was 13 years old. And so I wondered, what if, you know, this young woman had someone before she was 13, when she was 12 or when she was 11. And, you know, if you know me, you know that I love tweens. I think that young people before adolescence are hilarious. They're fun. They're genuine. They will tell you exactly what they really think. They will tell you about your hair and your shoes, and they will notice tiny little things about you that you think nobody else would notice. And I love spending my days with them. I love sharing books with young people. I have, you know, a car full of books all the time. There are a ton of teenagers on my street, and I'm always forcing books into their hands. And I get to spend the day doing what I love, sharing words and literature with young people.
How about you, Dave?
I'm an accidental teacher, I think. I probably, like many teachers in the audience and on stage, I was formed by the experiences I had with some really fantastic teachers. And by coincidence, after my sophomore year in college, one of my favorite teachers, my favorite teacher, who I was lucky enough to have for more than 1 year, said, you know what you should do? You should substitute, because college is off and school is still in session, and why not? Because they could use you. So at that point, there was such a shortage of substitute teachers in New Haven that 2 years of college was sufficient to make it into the classroom as a substitute. And I did. And I didn't love it. Substitute teaching is not the ideal job, you know? So that was by no means what drew me to teaching. But there was certainly something about the experience with students. Even if you make a momentary connection, you know, even, you know what really turned the corner for me accidentally? It was probably that I'm really good at remembering people's names. So if you can learn their names in the first 15 seconds, A, they can't get over on you, because they know that, you know, you can identify them later in the lineup, right? And B, you can call them by their name rather than, hey, you. And that, I think, even if it's not profound, it's enough to make a difference sometimes. And I think it's that kind of small difference that happens every day in a classroom that we don't even think about, but that happens every day for the students that changes lives. And you don't realize that, at least I didn't realize it, everybody else probably does, but I didn't really have that personal realization until probably 15 years into my teaching career.
I know all of you read Liz's piece, and I'm wondering if the other three panelists might talk a bit about maybe something that resonated with you when you see somebody who cares about this profession say to the world, why I want to give up teaching. It must strike a chord with you. Ebony, any thoughts about that? Any things that resonated with you?
One thing that popped out for me in Liz's piece is that teachers have very little autonomy. If you look at the AMA, that's run by doctors. If you look at the American Bar Association, that's run by lawyers. But the people who have the most to say about education and the biggest ear and the most power are people who have never spent a day in a classroom, or maybe a year, or maybe 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So be specific about how that affects you, about why that matters for people who aren't in the education profession.
Well, now I'm teaching in a school, an independent school, where teachers have a lot of autonomy. I feel like I'm treated like a professional every single day. And in my public school experience, I did not feel like I was treated like a professional. I felt like there's a lot of suspicion around teachers. Like, prove to me why you're here. Prove to me that you're not just some sort of upstart, I guess. And every teacher I know has a BA and most an MA. You've got to get an MA within 5 to 7 years. And people aren't just showing up to phone it in every day, because those people that do don't last.
Yeah. Liz, you're nodding your head there. This is something that resonates with you.
Absolutely. I've been really bothered by the fact that teachers are being evaluated with these binders of materials. And I've talked to some doctors and said, you know, how are doctors evaluated? Do you have a binder of evaluation materials? And they don't. And lawyers don't have a binder of materials. And doctors aren't sitting there and saying, well, my goal for this year is to save 85% of my patients.
I think somebody would lose their job.
That's ridiculous. That's, I mean, teachers... part of the reason that I went into this, honestly, you know, you're reminding me, I was in public relations, and there were a lot of people who thought they could do my job. They thought they could be a public relations professional. Anybody can hang out a shingle and be a public relations professional. I wanted to do something where I actually had credentials so that I could say I can do something that other people can't do, that I actually worked for a degree and have the credentials. So for the first number of years of my teaching career, I felt really proud of that. And my family and my friends were proud to introduce me as a teacher. And now suddenly I feel like I'm the enemy. Because I'm a teacher, I'm somebody who's failing children. And that was, you know, there isn't a teacher in this room who doesn't do everything he or she can for every child. And there's just this sense, you know, as Ebony was saying, of mistrust now. That somehow we're not really trying as hard as we could be. We're not doing our very best.
David Lowe, how about you? What resonated in Liz's piece for you, this idea?
Well, it's what I hear more often than not from teachers. And anecdotally, my wife, who's also a teacher, is on a blog or a BBS, you know, an internet online bulletin board, and it's a chat with moms who basically had children within the same 9-month period or so. So it's completely randomly distributed across the country. And there are probably maybe 40, 50 moms on this chat. And 11 of them are teachers. And at a certain point within the last 12 months, one of the other moms who's on this chat expressed her interest in going back to school. Because her children were growing to the point where they were in full-time daycare or school or something, and she was looking to take her next step professionally. And she said that what I really want to do is I want to go back to school and become a teacher. And 11 moms who are teachers all said, no, don't do it. Mm. Not 10, all 11 out of 11 said, that's not the choice you want to make right now.
It's not the choice you want to make right now. So, David Basso, I mean, would you tell someone, yeah, get into this profession right now. Now's the time.
I would tell them to get into the profession. Yeah. But I think there's an important need to understand the realities. So, you know, people come into the profession, especially young people out of college, they're very idealistic. To me, that idealism can't go away. It has to be tempered by or balanced by the daily realities. And some of those realities are changing. Mm. Some of those realities... again, those extrinsic motivators can never supplant the internal drive. I think we need excellent individuals who are going to be hardworking and know what they're getting into.
But talk about how you deal with those extrinsic motivators. I mean, this whole idea that teachers want to have some autonomy, that they want to be treated as though they not only are good at what they do, but that they care and that they're striving for success for themselves and their children. I can see how, if I did this, I'd feel a little bit beaten down over time. How do you deal with all the things you have to deal with?
Well, number one, I have a great wife who's a great teacher, and we work together. Sense of humor is key. I would think you've heard a lot of laughter already here this evening. And again, I keep going back to what's that primary motivating force? And so to me, it always, and I'm sure to everybody in this room, it always comes down to the students. And we all have, for example, I always use this example. My trophies over the course of my career are those thank you notes from kids, those emails from kids, you know, the student who writes back and says, thanks for making a difference. My first year teaching, as for many teachers, was a tough year. And I shared a room with a veteran educator who was probably going on 36, 37 years, and he had so much passion and enthusiasm. And I asked him, what keeps you going? And just that day, coincidentally, he received a note from a student from 20 years earlier that was thanking him. And He said, that's what keeps me going. And I think we can all relate to that.
We're listening back to a panel discussion that we held last week with teachers from across the state at CPBN's Learning Lab just upstairs from WNPR studios. You've been hearing from Liz Natale, who teaches English and Language Arts at Sedgwick Middle School in West Hartford, David Basso, who teaches in Berlin, Ebony Murphy Root, who is currently a middle school humanities teacher in New York City who taught in Hartford Public Schools, and David Lowe, who teaches aquaculture technology at the Sound School in New Haven. When we come back from our break, we'll take questions and comments from the audience, including some prospective teachers. You can watch the full uncut video of this discussion and continue our conversation on our website. Go to WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live with the hashtag Where We Teach. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're listening back today to a panel discussion with teachers and educators that we hosted at CPBN's Learning Lab last week. We held an evening panel so that we could get more teachers into this conversation since, well, they're normally teaching at this hour. Our panelists include Liz Natale, who wrote an op-ed for the Hartford Current, Why I Want to Give Up Teaching, David Basso, who's the 2012 Connecticut Teacher of the Year, Ebony Murphy Root, who's also written about education. She works at a private school now in New York City, and David Lowe, who teaches aquaculture technology and math at the Sound School in New Haven.
How else has it changed over the time that you've been teaching? I mean, we talk about some of the things, and obviously there's a lot in education that's changing or being proposed to change right now that we talk about in our program quite a bit. But I'll just start with you quickly, Liz, and just maybe go through some of the things that have changed over the time you've been teaching, things that maybe you haven't changed for the better.
I was having a conversation with someone who is a supervisor of a department in my building. It was not my direct supervisor. But who was saying that, oh, yes, we have all these sort of feel-good things that we can look to, these thank you notes and so forth, but we need data. And that's really what's killing me right now is this collection of data. I'm an English teacher. If I wanted to crunch numbers, I would have been a math teacher probably. but children are not data. You know, Dave was saying that these are children. And that's what motivates us. You can't boil them down to a number. And that's what's happening now with them, and it's happening to us as teachers. I've been at it for 15 years now, and on a scale of 1 to 4 in my recent formal observation, I came up as a 3 in most of the categories. And, you know, I know I'm probably a little bit insane about wanting to be a 4, but I'm thinking, you know, I'm better than that. I'm better than sort of this level that's down from being my best, because I do my best for children every day. But what they're looking at are all these indicators and trying to boil it down to numbers. That bothers me.
Well, David Lowe, you're a math guy. I mean, isn't data important? Don't we need data to be able to tell a story about how things are going in the world?
Data is important because you want to be able to use it to your advantage to tell the story you want to tell.
Tell me more about that.
So many times I'll be having conversations with people about teaching, learning, education, something, and inevitably somebody will say something about a result, like this school did this well or did that well. And what's either understood or unspoken is that based on what? Based on standardized test scores, of course, but that's just such an underlying assumption that we generally don't even question. It's sort of like, oh, well, then what happened to the test scores? Not should we be using them, because that's how you control the conversation, is that you start from the place where you've already won, essentially, and then you can niggle about the details. But we have to start questioning the underlying assumptions.
Ebony, I'd like you to weigh in on this about the underlying assumptions. Are we, when we try to measure teachers' performance, we try to measure students' performance, a lot of us in this room are going to say, well, we're measuring the wrong things. But what should we be measuring? I mean, aren't some measurements important of quality, of how we're doing on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. During my student teaching, I did my student teaching in a wonderful district, Wethersfield, with a wonderful language arts teacher who's now a principal in that district. And when we had meetings, we talked about, and these are just, you know, names, but Molly and Tyrone and Ivan and Lakeisha and where they started on day one and 3 months later where they were and where we wanted them to be 8 weeks from now for that one kid. And now we talk about data points, but I don't teach data points. I teach individual kids who are going to make individual leaps and bounds of progress. And sometimes they'll crawl, and then one day they'll have a major, you know, leap forward, and then maybe they'll take a step back. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't necessarily play well with crunching numbers.
What I'd like to find, though, tonight from the panel, and we're going to open this up to the audience in just a bit, is maybe some language, David Basso, to explain to the legislators, to the lawmakers, to the people who want to reform education, who are listening to our show, how to take what you're saying and put it into some sort of practice that makes sense. Because I get the feeling that just as much as the people who are here tonight who would take time out want to make things good for kids, there are an awful lot of people who try to make laws for a living, who want to make things good for kids. I truly believe that. But how do we communicate what you're saying to them in a way that makes sense?
That's a heck of a question. I think, first of all, the data is valuable and it's important. But what priority is it given? And when we talk about data, we get very often caught up in the quantitative data. And every teacher knows that teaching and learning is so multifaceted, it's so incredibly dynamic that it's very hard to capture. So I think the crux of the issue is this moment, this snapshot, rather than this very holistic understanding. So I think in terms of the dialogue that needs to take place, part of the issue is very often teachers might be invited, and very often they might be the token teacher. And I want to see that paradigm shift where a legislator calls one of us up or one of us in the audience up and says, what can you tell me? Rather than going into it with the presumption that they know because they spent some time in school. So the dialogue has to have a flattening rather than this hierarchical dialogue. And, you know, just like you're having this show this evening to accommodate us, and we're very thankful for that, a legislative session that involves education can't be happening at 10 in the morning because I'm going to be hard-pressed to leave my period four students.
I'd like to ask, start with Ebony, and we're probably going to get a lot of folks who want to chime in on this, but I'm going to ask a question that I keep asking people on my show when we talk about education, and nobody really gives me a very good answer. It seems as though when we talk about the problems in education, many people will say, well, the real problem is we don't have a mechanism to get rid of the really bad teachers, because really bad teachers are the problem. You know, the bad teachers who don't care about the kids. And I ask and I say, how many bad teachers are there? Like, in any given school, is it like one? Is it 20? I mean, is there one in every classroom? I have no idea. So you've taught a lot of different places, mm-hmm. private schools, public schools. How many bad teachers are out there, people who shouldn't be teaching kids?
Wow, great question. I think in any field, you'll find people who would be happier with some other job. There are nurses that I've come across that maybe they should pick something else, maybe floral arrangements or something. My dad's a truck driver. He's a Teamster. There are probably some guys who shouldn't be out there in the big rigs. And, you know, there are managers who, after that person has, you know, had a couple fender benders, they find something else to do. And I find that with teaching, that happens as well. One thing that happens in teaching that doesn't happen in other fields, I think, is that you can be at the wrong place for you. You can be in a place where you're not appreciated by the principal. You can be in a place where they don't really get who you are as a person or your background. You can be in a place where you and the students simply don't mesh, and maybe you'd be happier in another field. But what happens in teaching is that if you have a bad year in one place, especially in public schools, you can never teach again. And I've met some really great people who've been pushed out of teaching forever simply because they didn't mesh with one person, with a principal, with the person in power. And that happened to me when I taught in Hartford. And now I'm teaching a place where I feel very, very supported and appreciated, and where I mesh with the population. And so I think we need to be very careful about pushing people out of the profession who are really, really strong simply because they're in the wrong place.
And you're in a private school. You feel like you get the supports that these other teachers have been talking about, that you really want to be able to continue your career and thrive.
When I walk into the building every morning, I feel like I'm in the right place for me. And I think when teachers are in the right building for them, I think all teachers understand the Sundays, right? When you're teaching in the wrong place and you get the Sundays, that feeling about, you know, Sunday at 6 p.m. where I don't get that ever. Even when I think, oh, this Monday's going to be really rough, it's not the Sundays. And so I'm in the right place.
I'd like to just have the rest of the panel just maybe chime in just quickly. David, maybe you want to start on this idea, because it's a big part of the conversation that I have all the time. It's how do we improve educating by improving educators? And there's an underlying assumption again. Maybe, as you said before, we're dealing with the wrong assumptions, but an underlying assumption that we have a certain amount of teachers that just aren't good. We need to get rid of them, and we can't do it because of unions or some rules or something. I mean, what do you think about this idea?
I think the bigger question is, as David said, some of the structures that are in place. There are very, very few teachers who feel completely adequately prepared coming out of student teaching. So maybe there's a need to consider that student teaching experience. Maybe it needs to be lengthened. There are many teachers who might get supported for the first year or two, and then that sort of disappears because that formal structure doesn't exist anymore. So to me, the bigger question is, teachers are going to struggle at various points in their career, and very often it's younger ones. What supports are in place? Who is overseeing that situation? So if somebody comes in to observe me as a new teacher, and it wasn't a great performance on my part, the implementation of a lesson didn't go smoothly, between then and perhaps my next observation, there really needs to be an awful lot of support. And very often, we're left to flounder.
David, maybe quickly, you have any thoughts?
Absolutely. You talk to any teacher, they're going to want somebody to help them improve. And from a strictly business standpoint, you can talk about all the business models you want, whether they apply or not. But if you're just thinking about it from a business perspective, if you want your employees to produce, putting teachers at the base employee level, then how are you going to expect them to produce well if they're not happy, feeling good about going to, if they feel the Sundays, you know they're not going to be producing results for you. Never mind that the construct is wrong, never mind anything else. But if you hire someone, don't give them any development, don't train them in the job you're expecting them to do, and then say they're no good at it, what does that say about you as an employer? You can come into my classroom 17 times a day as long as it's there to help me get better. But if you're just coming in to play gotcha, then that's not going to help any of us.
Well, another thing that you talk about is leadership and the importance of building leadership and teacher leaders. And a pathway, if you talk about it from a strictly business professional standpoint, a pathway for teachers to be able to rise up through the ranks and be able to help other people. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, that's something you could spend the money I'm talking about on, right? I mean, that you could use in supporting teachers, it requires time. It requires the people to go in and either model for you or talk with you about the lesson. And if you're preparing five classes worth of lessons, whatever, lessons, good God. But if you're preparing these and you have correcting and you have parent contact and the time doesn't exist in your day to do these things, even if the money were to exist, right? So that's the kind of thing that money could actually prepare. You could spend 2 years doing your actual practicum rather than 10 weeks, is it, you know, getting ready to be a teacher. It just doesn't make any sense. And those are the things that aren't throwing good money after bad. Those are the things that could create the space to grow teachers into the kind of professionals that we want them to be.
Today we're listening back to a panel discussion that we call Where We Teach. Last week we gathered more than 70 teachers from around the state for an evening discussion about teaching in the era of standardized testing and education reform. The panelists are Liz Natale, who teaches English and Language Arts at Sedgwick Middle School in West Hartford, David Basso, who teaches Social Studies at Berlin High School, Ebony Murphy Root, who teaches Humanities in New York City, and David Lowe, who teaches at the Sound School in New Haven. You can continue this conversation on our website, WNPR.org, where we've got a video of all the night's activities. We'll be right back after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up in tomorrow's show, I'll be traveling, but Colin McEnroe will guest host our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, where he and our panel of reporters and news analysts will break down the week's news. You can join us, as always, online at WNPR.org. Today, we're listening back to a panel discussion that we hosted in the evening last week with teachers from around Connecticut. We wanted to know what it's like to be an educator in the era of Common Core, teacher evaluations, and education reform. We were joined by about 70 teachers, including our panel, Liz Natale, who teaches English and Language Arts at Sedgwick Middle School in West Hartford, David Basso, who teaches at Berlin High School, Ebony Murphy Root, who teaches in New York City, and David Lowe, who teaches at the Sound School in New Haven.
What I want to do is I'd like to throw this open to questions and comments from the audience. Hi there, what's your name? Where do you teach?
My name is Randall Prose. I teach at Wyndham High School in Willimantic, Connecticut. I teach social studies. I've been teaching for 20 years.
So tell me a little bit about your experience. What resonates with you on this conversation we've had so far?
A lot of what they're saying. We've had our own little experience in Willimantic. It's a proud town in eastern Connecticut, but we are probably the poorest school district in the state. I know we're in the top two or three, and we've struggled to provide what we need for our students. I mean, the recession that hit us 5 or 6 years ago, we lost like 70 teachers. We lost 6 budgets in 1 year, and the challenges that we faced were just tremendous. It was a really tough year. We still made a little growth in our test scores, which I hate the snapshot. If you're going to view, we felt like we were a very successful school system. We were very proud of what we had accomplished with the limited resources. And yet, you know, the state labeled us a failing school system. And we got a special master, you know, sent to town. Yeah, it's been a rough 3 years.
Well, can you just explain, I mean, for people who aren't in this world, you're appointed a special master. So what does that mean to you in the classroom?
I believe the legislators that drafted the bill had good intentions. You know, we were going to get an expert in education to come out and support our school system. That's what we were told. And he was there to work collaboratively with us and our community to help, you know, improve our school system. However, the person that was appointed, it did not roll out that way. It was a one-man dictatorship for 3 years. Teachers became very discouraged. You know, we tried to collaborate, and we got absolutely thrown out of meetings unless it was, you know, completely agreeing with whatever the special master said. He chopped our schools to pieces, and we fought, and our scores have plummeted. Teachers have left. We have over half of our staff in the first 2 years, a huge amount of TFA that were brought into our schools. And, you know, the special ed services were cut. Our bilingual program was cut. Everyone was thrown into our classes. It's been a real struggle. So it's not been a good experience as a teacher to, you know, we were hoping, and I was optimistic that the state support would be a little more, you know, on the ground and actually helping us improve our schools.
Thank you very much for joining us. Hi there. What's your name and where do you teach or do you teach?
My name's Daniel. I don't teach yet. I am a conditionally accepted student in the Master's in the Art of Teaching at Central Connecticut State University because I do want to go into this profession despite all the warnings against the idea. And partly because I do think that there is a really important struggle growing up here. And there's two things that keep coming into my mind in this conversation. If you want better teachers, then what do? You give more support. You require more training. If you want to improve education, you reduce the class size. And you make it a job that people want to go into. So you get the best talent. You get the best mathematicians, the best writers. But what's happening? They're reducing the number of teachers, increasing class size. They're introducing less skilled teachers through Teach for America and other places, and they're making it a miserable place so that people like me are being warned away from going into the profession. So to me, this doesn't look like a mistaken thing. This looks like a very conscious policy, which leads me to the second point, which one of the teachers in Chicago, when the teachers union there went on strike, made very clearly. She said, "Our working conditions are your children's learning conditions." And the attack on teachers is also an attack on students. So if you're going to create an atmosphere where everyone is being de-skilled, you've got to lower the level of education altogether.
Well, and thank you very much for that. I'd just like to maybe go to our panel quickly and just ask, Liz, this idea of the atmosphere of a school is incredibly important. And I don't know if you can just, for those of us who don't spend all day in a school, talk about that, about how a good school atmosphere helps the learning process and how a bad school atmosphere can hurt.
Yeah, I think you want to have teachers who are excited, you know, as Ebony was saying, excited to be there. The kids need to feel as if we care about them. So you need to have those smaller class sizes where you can actually get to know children. You know, to me, the best way to get a student to learn is to get that student on my side, to be able to connect with that student on a personal level. And we aren't always given those opportunities.
I'd like to get to another question over. Hi there. What's your name?
Hi, my name's Matt Timlin, and I'm not a teacher yet either. Much like the last speaker, I'm going to be starting my master's in education this summer. And I just want to take a second to express some gratitude for you guys doing this, because anytime I tell anyone that I want to be a teacher, I've been an engineer for the last 5 years, and it's my hope to teach high school physics in inner city public schools. And anytime I tell anyone that, they get this really sideways look on their head and say, "Are you crazy?" And I'm getting sick of getting all of the naysayers telling me not to do it and get out now while I still can. And, you know, all the people that are saying don't do it, they're being listened to. And a lot of potentially good teachers are getting scared off. And, you know, no one's going to try and argue that it's going to be an easy job, or that, you know, obviously I don't really know what I'm getting into until I get into the trenches myself. I recognize that. But I'm not looking for an easy job. The point isn't to have an easy job. The point is to have a job that matters. And, you know, I can't say that about what I've been doing the last 5 years.
Thank you. I will say that if the teaching thing doesn't work out, you have a great radio voice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us. Hi there. What's your name?
I'm Allison. I've worked as both a classroom teacher and a school-based mentoring program supervisor in both suburban and urban districts. And I have a question actually for the panel. You've addressed a bit how recent changes in education have affected your working environment. Can you speak more specifically to how the shift to data and assessment-driven education has affected your students and the way your students learn and behave over the past several years?
It's a great question. Ebony, how about you? You are not as big a part of this world right now in the school that you're in, but maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, I think it's very important to look at the sorts of schools that the people most in power send their kids to in this country. And this is not a right or left thing. Look at the school where President Obama sends his daughters. Just Google it up. Look at the school where Bill Gates sends his kids, Lakeside School in Seattle. It's public information. Look at the school where Chris Christie sends his kids. So those people understand that they want their kids to have free time, time to read in class, sports, art, dance, teachers who have unlimited PD, and then look at the schools that they're trying to develop for the people with the least amount of power in our society. And it's like night and day. And I don't think it's acceptable for the people who are most in power to set up a system like that. Where I teach now, I have amazing PD anytime I want, whatever I need, wonderful resources. I think if every teacher in this country had what I have every single day on the Upper West Side of New York City, we would see amazing results immediately. We are simply unwilling to do that.
Does anybody else on the panel want to address the question?
Go ahead, Lisa. I don't, you know, I'm not against data. I've always looked at the CMT scores that came back. I do think they're just a snapshot in time. I know kids who have done really poorly on them because they've panicked. But, you know, I'd be happy to give a child a test with a piece of paper and a pencil. And my 6th and 7th graders will tell you that they love computers. They love to play computer games. They like looking at the internet. They like doing PowerPoint presentations. They do not want to be tested on a computer. And that's what's happened to a lot of this, is I've spent more time this year trying to simulate the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium, these SBAC tests, trying to simulate for those things for them. So rather than taking time to really read a novel and go deep and really think critically, which is what I thought the Common Core was going to do, instead we're coming up with these really contrived assessments where half the screen is the story that you're going to read and half the screen is the test that you're going to take, and you have to scroll up and down and click here and listen to this. I thought we were going to get back to sort of the basics and look at kind of the liberal arts disciplines that Ebony was talking about. But instead, this 21st century skill seems to be to put a child in front of a computer and see if they can manipulate the computer.
What is a 21st century skill?
Well,
it's a 19th century skill 200 years later.
Yeah. Suddenly there's a shift in English and language arts into this nonfiction genre. And, you know, to me, since when is fiction not critical thinking? You know, 21st century skills, I don't think are computers. I think I'm not opposed to technology. I'm married to a guy who uses technology, but he uses it as a tool. I think students need to learn to read and write and do mathematics and think critically and know a lot about the world. And then they can use technology to advance what they know and to apply what they know. But 21st century skills, I don't think, are any different than the skills that we've had all along. That's my opinion.
I was talking to a friend of mine who was a principal in Massachusetts, and I asked him essentially this conversation about, you know, how is this impacting your work life? And he said he's not able to get out of his office as much anymore, much like David was referring to, and because he's doing paperwork. And that top-down control eventually is going to impact the classroom. And so if administrators are concerned about paperwork and checklists and essentially compliance rather than growth, that environment starts to turn into a controlling environment, and that's going to have a negative impact on students.
And I do want to get to another question quickly, but when you use that word compliance, it resonated with me, something that Ebony said before, this idea that there needs to be a certain level of trust that you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And without trust, people expect that there's compliance. I mean, you really only need to test people all the time to make sure that they're doing okay if you truly in your heart don't believe that they're doing a very good job in the first place. So is trust a big piece of what's missing, trust in teachers?
Trust is inherent. It's inherent in the building. It's inherent between policymakers and teachers. I don't know if it's inherent in the relationship between teachers
but
and students.
But I guess what I'm saying is it eroding? Is the trust between the people who make decisions about how you do the testing and the teachers, is it eroded?
I think so. I think so. And I think, and to look at the long view, I think it's been eroding since at least A Nation at Risk, when the dialogue and the narrative has been about schools are failing and a rising tide of mediocrity and we need to fix everything. When you get hit from various angles, yeah, that's going to make a difference in how.
It's worth making the point that A Nation at Risk was falsified, right? They took data that didn't actually say what it said and they told the story they wanted to tell, which, and specifically, that if you look at the subgroup data within the scores they were looking at, again, the scores were going up. But since more people were taking the test, the overall scores were going down because more people were being included in the testing. But that aside, it's back to the what are you doing with the people who need the help and who need the support? If you want to talk industrial model, it doesn't. We cannot sit here and say that there aren't horrible teachers out there. There are horrible teachers out there. I know them. You know them. Let's not dance around it. But the question is, what are you doing about it? When was the last time anybody did anything to support them, to help them get better, to show them a path to succeed and be a great teacher? Because there's not a single teacher in any classroom that I know of or whoever met or have ever met that wants to be a bad teacher. They just haven't got the tools that can help them be a better teacher. So nobody should make the assumption that teachers are saying that all teachers are great. They're not. But if you're going to hire them, you got to invest in them, and you got to do something to actually help them improve, mm-hmm. because that's to all of our benefit.
I want to get to some more questions. Who's got the microphone here? Hi there. What's your name?
My name is Ted Gerner. I've been teaching for 20 years, 6 years in Texas, and then I moved here to Connecticut. I want to say I'm very impressed with the panel that you have, and I continue to be very impressed with the quality of teachers in Connecticut. In Texas, I was voted by my peers to be a teacher of the year in the middle school level in a very big district in San Antonio, 11 middle schools. I thought pretty highly of myself. That was on my resume. When I came to Connecticut, after several years, I truly feel as though I'm average, or maybe slightly above average, compared to my peers. We have amazing teachers in Connecticut. We need to realize that. You get the impression that Connecticut is failing, and it's not. It's doing extremely well. We have the answer here in our state. You know, we have one of the biggest achievement gaps in the nation, but we have one of the biggest economic gaps in the nation. It goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Our schools are just a reflection of our society. So
from an education standpoint, because I think one of the problems is that we need to solve those underlying economic problems that cause the achievement gap, but that's going to take a lot of work. from a lot of people, and we may not have the will politically to be able to do some of those things. How do you think, from an education perspective, we can start to narrow that gap? Is there something that schools could do, or are we just looking in the wrong place if we say that?
I don't know what the answer is. Maybe it's in the funding. Maybe the funding needs to be equalized because, as you said before, our schools are funded primarily through local taxes.
Yeah.
So maybe that whole paradigm needs to be changed. I'm not sure, but we have the best teachers, some of the best teachers in the nation here in this state. We need, you know, if we're looking for answers, we don't need to look far.
David Boss, I'm going to end with you. And the reason I want to is because as much as we've talked in the last year about education and education reform, in my world, we've been talking about something else quite a bit more. It was an event that happened at a school. On 9/11, or not 9/11, I think about it in the same terms as 9/11, at Sandy Hook Elementary School in December of 2012. And you've written about this a little bit. I will say, and I said this on the air when Colin McEnroe and I were doing a special on the one-year anniversary of Sandy Hook, we fought in the press very hard to get the 9/11 tapes from that day released because we wanted to hear what was happening. Eventually, those became public, and I listened to those tapes. And a lot of people said, well, it was horrible, and it was hard to listen to. But it struck me, David, I heard the most remarkable things from the people there who were protecting those kids. And I think it's interesting that we're having this conversation, an emotional conversation, obviously, for all of us, but about what teachers do and what they're worth and how we can get them to be better. When I heard that, I thought, my God, those people really cared a lot, put their lives on the line. It's interesting that that's not more part of the conversation that we've had in the last year and a half. That seems like it should be almost all the conversation. I heard on those tapes people who just would do anything to save those kids.
One of the reasons that I felt compelled to write that is, much like everybody, I was just numb. And I don't think I'm very emotional, but boy, was that, it's unfathomable. And I said, I have to do something. But I felt so much like there was nothing I can do. And so if anything, I wanted to thank the teachers, and not just the teachers in Newtown, but teachers everywhere, because there are thousands of sacrifices that we all make. There are so many little things that we do that make that one little thing can make a huge difference. And it might just be something like saying good morning to a student. And so, you know, teaching is an emotional job. To go back to what I said earlier, we're drawn to that moral purpose, and you can't separate the moral purpose from the emotional nature of what we do. And I think part of it was in this context of, you know, we tend to be a somewhat self-deprecating profession. We say, you know, well, I'm just a teacher. You know, what do I know about policy, or what do I? And I want to change the language around that. These individuals and teachers everywhere are so much more than just a teacher. They are so proud to be teachers, and you know, there are the tornadoes in Oklahoma and stories of teachers who were protecting their students. There's a story of the snowstorms in Atlanta where teachers stayed overnight and read to the students. I mean, the things that we do just intuitively is driven by those core values. And I just think, to some extent, at a very minimal extent, I wanted to at least try to capture that.
I want to thank you very much for not only for writing that piece, but also for joining us today in the panel. David Basso from Berlin High School, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
I want to thank Liz Natale, who teaches at Sedgwick Middle School and wrote this op-ed that got us all thinking about this issue and helped to get us together today. Liz, thank you very much.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thanks. This was fun.
Ebony Murphy Root teaches in New York City, but she lives in Hartford. She's been a teacher at several schools here, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us as well.
Thanks so much for having me. Calhoun students, go to bed.
And David Lowe teaches aquaculture technology and math at the Sound School in New Haven. Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for adjusting your schedule to make teachers accessible to the whole process. Thanks.
Thank you all for joining us. I really do want to continue this conversation. It's an important one to have, and I hope you all come back and talk with us again about teaching at some point in the near future. Thanks. Thanks very much. If you'd like to watch full video of this event, you can see it on our website, WNPR.org. And if you know a teacher who hasn't heard or seen this yet, share it. We'd like to keep this conversation going. Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Solarski. Special thanks to Heather Brandon, Jay Holt, Eugene Amatruda, Paul Pfeffer, Matt Rose, Tess Aronson, Donna Shadipo. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.